And now, from the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio, The Axe Files, with your host, David Axelrod.
First, happy Thanksgiving to all of you. I hope you are having a wonderful day with the people you love. We're taking the week off, but I did want to reshare a conversation I had a while back with Anderson Cooper after the publication of his book Vanderbilt about his famous star-crossed family. And on this day of love and reflection, I'd also highly recommend Anderson's new podcast, All There Is, in which he explores stories of loss and grief with all the insight and sensitivity of one who has experienced it in his own life. Please give this podcast a listen, and his as well, and we'll see you all next week. Anderson Cooper, good to see you, my friend. You know, I worry about you all the time that you're not busy enough. And so I was really gratified to hear that you have another book out.
Yeah, I know. It's been, it seemed like a wise idea. Especially when I was having a baby. I thought, why not?
Yeah, exactly. And doing your show and 60 Minutes and your online show and, you know, other stuff.
I'm working on an Icecapades version of my life.
So. Excellent. Looking forward to that.
I'm excited about it.
This book, though, is so interesting to me. It's called Vanderbilt, The Rise and Fall of an American Dynasty. You co-wrote it with Catherine Howe. The thing that's interesting about it is this is your family. And it's a family that, as you write in this book, I've always gone out of my way to avoid mentioning my relation to the Vanderbilts. When someone would find out and ask me, what was it like to grow up a Vanderbilt? My response was always the same. I don't know. I'd say I'm a Cooper. That is how I viewed myself and still do. I look to my father's large family with its deep roots in the Mississippi earth, and I've taken their American story as my own. So why is this book about the Vanderbilts and not the Coopers?
I think because I didn't know really anything about the Vanderbilts. I mean, I knew a little bit, obviously. I'd been to the Breakers once or twice, which is this big house in Newport, Rhode Island, which my great grandfather built.
Yes. House is a little understated, but yes.
Yeah. It's a very gaudy palace is what it is. And that was their summer house. The actual house that they lived in New York was where Bergdorf Goodman department store is now. So that footprint. It's very relatable. I know. But I really didn't know. I'd intentionally avoided learning about them, focusing on them, thinking about them. I didn't want to feel kind of related to them because I felt like no good could come of it when I was a kid and sort of trying to model how I'm going to live a life and how I'm going to make a life. And it just seemed like best to avoid altogether. But having a son of my own made me kind of think, well, what am I going to say to him one day about them if I don't know anything about them? And I don't want him to feel that there's some reason I don't know anything about them and there's something weird about it, or, that I'm trying to avoid talking about something. And which is how, you know, my mom didn't talk about the Vanderbilt. She felt like a stranger in that family, in the little contact that she had had with them throughout her life, and especially as a kid. So I just thought, you know, I should stop avoiding this. I'm an adult. I should look at this and look at it as I would as a reporter and as, someone obviously uniquely connected to it, but at the same time, looking at it from an outsider's perspective.
And we should just, for those who are unaware, the Vanderbilt family, the Vanderbilts were the wealthiest and most prominent family in America in the 19th century. Your great, 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 I forget how many greats there are associated with it. Cornelius Vanderbilt was a self-made, what would in today's terms be a billionaire, first in shipping and then in rail. That's where this story sort of begins. But you describe it. Let me just read your words again, because I should preface this by saying one of the things that has struck me about you, we've had a chance to work together for some years now, is that I would describe you as deeply skeptical of power and privilege. Yes. And I would describe you as very empathetic to people who are struggling and suffering. And those are sort of hallmarks of your journalism. You wrote at the end of your introduction here, the United States, a country founded on anti-royalist principles, would only 20 years after its revolutionary burst into existence produce the progenitor of a family that would come to hold itself up as American royalty with the titles and palaces to prove it, but their empire would last for less than 100 years before collapsing under its own weight, destroying itself with its own pathology. Describe that pathology.
Well, the Commodore, who is the person who made the fortune, I mean, the first Vanderbilt came to America, had no money. The first Vanderbilt came to America was a guy named Jan Artsen Vanderbilt. It's not known exactly when, but it was sometime probably in the mid-1600s. And he, in order to get passage from the Netherlands, which is where, from Holland, which is where he was born, and that's where the name comes from, Vanderbilt, which is the Bilt is the town in Holland where he came from. He had to sell his labor and sign an indenture. He became an indentured servant and, you know, and promised to work for somebody or a wealthier person in the New World for 5 years or whatever the length of the indenture was. So Commodore Vanderbilt is the one who made the fortune. And the way he made it was from the time he was, I don't know, in utero, or at the very least when history starts to record some of his activity, which was when he was 11 and drops out of school and starts working on a small boat, ferrying supplies from New York to from Staten Island to Manhattan. He had a pathological obsession with money, and he himself called it a mania for money later in life. It was the sole focus of his interests. Money would give him power and freedom and to make more money. And that's what he was interested in. He wasn't interested in building palaces like his grandchildren would ultimately be interested in, and which ultimately would lead to one of the reasons of the sort of the fall of the fortune of the Vanderbilts. He lived off Washington Square Park. He had a nice house, but it wasn't some crazy palace. And he had no interest in the social world of New York City. He wasn't accepted in it. He was viewed as an uncouth merchant. He was kind of illiterate. He could barely read and write, or at least not very well. And he was a bore. He would go, you know, the few dinner parties he'd be invited to, he would be, you know, spitting on the floor and cursing. And he ended up dying of venereal excesses, which, you know, is a very kind of Victorian term for,
yes,
not a pleasant way to die, among many other ailments. But so I think that pathology, his pathological obsession with money and not caring about the women in his family because they wouldn't carry the Vanderbilt name. His daughters, who he had many, would, you know, change their names once they got married and they wouldn't work. And so they weren't really worth much in his mind. And his
In fact, in the family mausoleum, there are no women buried.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. That's traditionally. Yeah. And actually, a cousin of mine has offered to have my mom be the first one whose remains could be in the mausoleum. I'm not sure how my mom would feel about it, so I haven't made that decision yet. But I appreciate the offer. It's very sweet, you know. And I like the idea of the Commodore sort of having to make way and make room and you know, getting all upset about having a trailblazing woman in the mausoleum. But, I think that kind of obsession about money, it infects everyone around. It infected the family of the Commodore, and infected how he dealt with people, and infected how he viewed life. And it, in some cases, the desire for money by, you know, his children, or the absence of the money, it had ripple effects. You know, for some of the kids who weren't going to get the money, the absence of that money, the thought of that money, that huge fortune, more money than anyone had ever amassed before, going to their brother or some member of the family and not them, that had its own pathological and ripple effects in their life. And I think that, to me, that was what was interesting, as sort of how money infects one person, and then like a cancer spreads to everyone around them through the generations, and to see how the ripple effects of that first fortune, what ripple effects it had on the lives of all these people.
Yeah, one of the stories that touched me was of his son, who had epilepsy. I have a child with epilepsy, and he had it was not uncommon in that time to think of epilepsy as sort of demonic possession or mental illness. He had the son institutionalized several times. He shunned him, warned people off of the son.
The son was also, you know, gay, although in that time, obviously, people didn't use that term. But I don't know how much, you know, that was sort of known at the time. I mean, contemporaneous accounts have, you know, it describes sort of his special friend who would travel with him, even though he was married to a woman for a while. So, but yeah, that, you know, for Cornelius Jeremiah, who's the son with epilepsy, I mean, the Commodore viewed him as weak and not worth really paying attention to. And it dominated his life. I mean, he lived this life sort of in the shadows of the Vanderbilts. And, you know, it had like cascading effects in his life.
Jay Rockefeller, who hails from another prominent family of that
I've heard of them,
era. Yes. He was campaigning in West Virginia, and he always used to tell this joke that, you know, look, I'm just like any other kid. My family, when I was little, my parents gave me blocks to play with, 48th Street, 49th Street, you know. But the expectation of to be a Vanderbilt meant you were wealthy, and all these folks through the generations behaved as if they were and spent wildly and lavishly.
Yeah, I mean they, and again, I think that's part of the pathology, the infection of it. I do think, you know, Willie K. Vanderbilt, who was my he's my great grandfather's brother. I'm still confused by who all these people are at times, but he's my great grandfather's brother.
Yeah.
Thankfully there is one in the book, but he, you know, toward the end of his life, he gave a quote to the New York Times saying that, you know, inherited money essentially is a vice like cocaine, that it leads to apathy. It leads to, you know, sucking your initiative. And I very much believe that. I do think you see a lot of that. I mean, I think some of the descendants of the Commodore, you know, were remarkable people and made contributions to society. Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney was this kind of remarkable, you know, woman who lived a dual life and had enormous fortune, founded the Whitney Museum with her art collection, and was an artist, a legitimate artist in her own right. But I think having that name Vanderbilt, you know, would she have perhaps been a far better artist had she not had that name? Would people have taken her more seriously? I mean, my mom obviously benefited from that name in business, but at the same time, you know, she got attention for it in some realms and probably attention that wasn't really reflective of who she was in other realms. And I think I was very glad to grow up not with that name.
You call her the last Vanderbilt. That's how you describe your mom. Obviously, that's not technically true, but it was, you know, her story is obviously central to you. And it's such a painful story. Mm. You know, the story, I mean, obviously she overcame a lot and her spirit overcame a lot. But the story of her childhood, and as retold in this book, you know, and you should narrate it a little, but, you know, her father died when she was an infant. Her mother was 20 and completely incapable of caring for her. And then she became sort of a pawn in this larger scheme that was also motivated by money. People trying to get a hold of this inheritance that she had and for their own purposes. Talk a little bit about that, because it's kind of an unimaginable story.
Yeah, it is. And it took me a long time to kind of even understand all the ramifications of it, and took my mom her lifetime to kind of work through it all. And her father, who was an alcoholic, died at 45 of alcoholism, cirrhosis of the liver. His esophagus exploded, and his deathbed scene was so bloody that his wife couldn't come in because there was blood projectile vomited onto the walls. He had gone through his entire fortune. Everything he had to be sold off to pay his debts. He had really done really very little with his life other than drink absinthe and you know, have a horse farm and enjoy himself and gamble. And he was, you know, that's my grandfather. And it's a pretty sad existence. And, you know, his mom, my mom's mom was, as you said, was a kid. I mean, she was 1920 and suddenly she's a widow and she has this infant. She has no real sense of being a parent and takes my mom to Europe for the first eight years of her life. My mom described it as actually a happy time because she had a nurse who she loved. She had a governess and she had her grandmother, her mother's mother. And that was, those were the two people in her life. She didn't know her mom. Her mom was this distant figure kind of going off to parties. And the nurse and her grandmother plotted, against my mom's mom, thinking that my mom's mom was irresponsible and that my mom should be taken back and live with the Vanderbilts in America and be raised a Vanderbilt. And that's, they hatched a plot to make that happen. And they made it happen. Courts got involved. My grandmother, my mom's mom, realized that if she didn't have custody of her child, then she would not be getting a stipend to live on from the inheritance that my mom would get when she turned 21, because that's how she was living. She didn't have money of her own. So there was a huge court battle. My mom was given over to Gertrude Vanderbilt Whitney to be raised in her teenage years. And that was really the first time my mom had any connection to the Vanderbilt family. When she was 10, suddenly she finds herself, her nurse is taken away, and she finds herself living with this woman she doesn't know in a huge compound out in Old Westbury, Long Island. And, you know, it forever changed the trajectory of my mom's life. And I think that, again, it's the battle. It's one of the ripple effects of money. And it's one of the ripple effects of expectations and people living far above their means. And it's the things that happen as a ripple effect of all this money. And obviously, look, my mom, you know, would not think of her life as a tragedy in any way. I think she was eternally kind of optimistic and could power through anything and remain vulnerable. And I think that was my mom's greatest strength to kind of, it was not pleasant at times because she would repeatedly be hurt and disappointed by things, but she, you know, believed in love above anything and loved being in love and loved beautiful things and loved creating things. And, you know, she determined very early on that she had a rock hard diamond at her center that could get her through anything and that she would propel herself forward no matter what. And that's what she did for her whole life.
The whole episode of her trial was huge national news. This was front page news in the middle of the Great Depression.
Yeah. It was an incredible soap opera of this battle among the richest family, you know, what was perceived as the richest family in the world, battling over this little girl. And people in America, all across America, and all, people all over the world follow this thing. I mean, there were, you know, dozens, if not hundreds of reporters in the courtroom following this thing. There were hundreds of people outside watching the comings and goings every day to the trial of these rich, you know, incredibly rich people. At the height of the Depression, my mom remembered, you know, driving one day in a car in a Rolls Royce in 1932, going to the trial, and she had detectives with her, and there was, for, you know, concerns about kidnapping, and seeing people on you know, selling apples on the street and waiting on bread lines, and somebody came into the car and, you know, had seen her in the papers and said, you know, little Gloria, please help me, help me. And that was what my mom's memory of the Depression was, which is obviously is very, you know, she was very lucky not to have the economic impact of it. But I think she, that, you know, it, that experience of going through that and having these people who you thought you loved and who loved being taken away from you, and suddenly you're not sure who you can trust, and being thrust into a global spotlight like that. You know, people were taking, there were people, there would be protests of, you know, this, there would be some demonstrators would want my mom to be, you know, that the little girl should be left with her mother, or mothers should always have their children. And then others would say, you know, the mother's a lesbian, she's not responsible, she should go to the Aunt Gertrude. And, you know, it was a crazy trial. It was considered the trial of the century at the time. The country hadn't seen anything like it.
We're going to take a short break, and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now, back to the show. you mentioned the mother being considered a lesbian. That was part of, in the trial, there was this revelation that she had had an affair with a woman.
Yeah, her right. Her one of her maid testified against her that she had seen her in bed with Lady Milford Haven. Again, very yes. relatable.
Yes, yes.
They were kissing like a married couple. That was what yeah. some of the maid said.
You've talked about your mother being sort of insensitive on this issue and kind of homophobic. And do you trace that back to that?
I wouldn't say homophobic. I mean, I think, you know, I think anytime your child tells, you know, she traced her concern that brand of lesbian, which her mother was branded with during this trial, was a huge, I mean, in 1932, it was unthinkable. You know, the courtroom was shut down. It was a scan, you know, it was just a scandal on top of a scandal. There were, you know, people whispered about it. And I think it made my mom very kind of, it made it kind of dirty and fearful in her mind. I mean, throughout her life, she had tons of gay friends and they were treated as, you know, I remember there was a guy named Jose Quintero, who's a famous theater yeah, sure. director, mm-hmm. and he did a lot of Eugene O'Neill plays. And he and his partner, Nick, you know, they would come to our house for dinner all the time. My mom loved them. And I remember saying to her when I was a little kid one time, like, you know, why are they, you know, who, tell me about them. Who are they? And she said, well, they're like a married couple. They're together. And that's why they both come and they sit at the table and, you know, and we seat them like a married couple. And so, you know, that really sunk into my mind. But I think she always had this, I think, fear that she was somehow going to be labeled a lesbian and that she was like her mother. And it was less about really, it was sort of fear of her mother more than anything else. So yeah, when I told her I was gay, you know, she said, well, don't make any definite decisions, which, you know, I had phrased it like, I think I'm gay, which I probably, you know, I was beyond thinking. I knew very, very firmly. And she knew the boyfriend I had at the time and, you know, loved him. But, you know, so it took her a little while, I think, to kind of get over her relation in her mind with her mom and that subject. But I mean, she was incredibly accepting.
She was married a bunch of times before yep. she married your dad. And what was she searching for?
She was searching for, you know, my mom, which I very much relate to her on this, is she had these kind of competing desires. She was searching for, above all else, in her mind, a family and a house, the white picket fence, and that life, that fantasy of that life. When she had that, it was not enough for her, and she blew it up. And, you know, her first marriage was a disaster. It was to this guy who was a thug. Instead of marrying Howard Hughes, who wanted to marry her, which I would have fully backed because it was like hot Howard Hughes. It wasn't the crazy Howard Hughes who ended up in the Vegas hotel. It was a thug who worked for Howard Hughes, you know, and he beat her, and they lived on an army base in Kansas during the war. Her second husband, Leopold Sikofsky, she built a family with, and she had two sons. And I think, like, you know, I think anybody who has been grown up in a family that's not really like a family and doesn't have an experience of a family has a hard time. You know, they yeah. have a fantasy of what it's going to be like, and obviously it's very different and difficult. And I think she found her limitations early on.
He was also, what, 41 years older than her or something
yeah, she,
like that?
He was like 63 when they met and she was 21, which is kind of, I mean, it's fascinating to me because, you know, you hear that and you think, oh, well, like, was she a gold digger? Was she, you know, he was a famous conductor. But she was 21 and stunningly beautiful and also stunningly wealthy. She had just inherited, I don't know, $4 or $5 million in 1941, which is, I think, you know, it's the equivalent of like $60 million today. So she wasn't searching for money. You know, it was clearly there were like father issues of his age and his stability. Yeah. And he was a genius, and that was very attractive. And the fact that a genius would be interested in her, and she had a low self-esteem and all that. But she, what propelled her was she wanted to, she quoted this line from a play, and I can't remember what the play is, but the character says, I want to be seen, heard, and felt. And that's, I think it's what we all want, but she certainly wanted that very much. And she got pulled in a lot of different directions of, did she want to be an actress, an artist, a writer, whatever it was. A lot of those drives to make something of her own life was in competition with this fantasy of having a family and a house with a white picket fence. And so it was always a pull between those.
find that in your dad?
I think she did. I mean, she found somebody who really had experience with a family. He'd grown up on this farm in Mississippi, and it had really, you know, impacted the way he saw things. And, you know, his experience of the Depression was a very different experience than my mom's. He was on a farm, you know, farm in Mississippi with, you know, and he spent the war. My grandmother, his mom, they moved to New Orleans so she could work in a factory making, you know, helping make amphibious assault craft at the Higgins Hughes plant in New Orleans. And she also sold ladies' hats at Maison Blanche department store. You know, I think he knew what a family was, and he knew what he wanted his family to be with my mom and having us, my brother and I, and he was a great, great father. And I think that really, that model really helped my mom a lot. Nothing was ideal, but it was certainly the closest she had ever gotten to that, what she had been looking for.
And then she... And you lost him when he was just 50 years old.
Yeah. Yeah, he died. Yeah, he was 50. I was 10. You know, at the time, of course, 50 seemed really old to me, but I didn't realize why people kept saying, oh, my God, he was so young. But now, of course, I think, Jesus.
Yeah. How did she, having found this, how did she process that loss?
You know, she needed to work. She didn't, you know, the money that she had inherited, she had, by the time she married my dad, most of it was not there anymore, and she needed to work. And so, you know, we were moving constantly. I didn't realize it at the time, but I realize now we were moving a lot every 4 years because my mom could not stop spending money, and she couldn't stop like redecorating the buildings that we lived in. So she would move into a place and then, you know, spend a lot redecorating and making it beautiful, and it wasn't sustainable. She then would have to, you know, 2 years down the road or 3 years down the road, sell it in order to make the profit from it and then go to another place and do the same thing all over. And she couldn't adjust. She could not, you know, I say in the book, nobody can spend money like a Vanderbilt. And she, to the end of her life, she was doing this. I mean, it was exhausting and it was very destructive for her. And I would try to, as I became more conscious of it, and as, you know, as a teenager, I would try to explain to her things that I had no interest in, you know, financial stuff. It confuses me, and I'm not wired like that, but I would read stuff about it to kind of give her advice and say things to her that I'd read, like, you know, saving money is making money, which, you know, she would look at me like I was just talking gibberish. So when my dad died, she was the jeans thing that she had done, which was like the first Laurie designer Vanderbilt jeans. Yeah. That was just starting. And so she plunged head first into that, and she was traveling around the country promoting it, and, you know, it became a big success. And there wasn't much kind of dealing with the death of my dad. I mean, it was something we all dealt with, but she had to work, and she was out there, and I had a nurse who, like a nanny, who I loved as my mother, and she's the person I spent all my time with and was devoted to, and it wasn't until kind of later on that I really got to know my mom more, you know, once my nurse was fired and it was my mom, you know, I was stuck, I was with my mom more. That's when I sort of got to know her.
What struck me in reading this book is that though you step outside of all of this, and as you say, you report on it, you're also you were kind of a victim of this pathology as well. I mean, you know, when you describe your growing up, being distant from your mother, obviously she was a loving mother in a way that her mother was not. But she was an absent mother a lot.
Yeah.
There was some parallelism there with her own childhood, which...
Absolutely. Which is fascinating. I mean, that's one of the things I was motivated me on this book is I'm fascinated by the cycles that we are, the patterns that we all have, patterns that each of us has in our own lives that we see play out in our own lives, but also patterns that families have or... you know, pathologies that families have that gets passed down, and things that are done to one family, you know, one parent to a person as a child, when they are a parent, they often repeat that. And, you know, my mom had this nanny who she loved, who was taken away from her. I had this nanny who I loved, who really raised me. And, you know, she was fired in a very kind of awful way by my mom at a time when I was, you know, 14. So I didn't need, she wasn't like bathing me anymore. I wasn't a little kid,
right?
But she was, for all intents and purposes,
emotional sustenance. Yeah.
Yeah. She was the person that, who was there, who I could talk to and stuff. And, you know, and it was interesting to me because I would say that I said that, you know, to my mom at the time, and it was like a blind spot. She couldn't see that pattern. She was like, well, it's completely different circumstances. And it actually, it wasn't that different actually in a lot of ways. I mean, but I was very sympathetic to that, those patterns. I was aware of those patterns and I was sympathetic to my mom above all else. I didn't expect my mom to be able to do more than she could do. And I didn't think, her heart was in the right place, and I knew she loved me, and I knew she was working to support us, and I knew she needed help. And I knew I don't have time to like, I didn't have, to, you know, I thought I'm not going to be this rebellious teenager because like I need to cut her some slack. Like she doesn't need a rebellious teenager. She needs actually like some wise counsel.
Yeah.
And so
I admire you for that's an awful lot. That's an awful burden for a young guy who's lost the dad he was really close to. And
yeah, it's definitely, you know, fucked up. I mean, it's not, but look, I can imagine somebody listening to this and being like, oh wow, boohoo, like this is a very high class problem. And you know, you're living in a very nice house. You're not on the street. And that is absolutely the case. I mean, I was in a, you know, very privileged, I'm incredibly privileged in how I grew up and the opportunities that were available to me and the things I had access to and the people I had access to, without a doubt. So I, you know, I don't want to, you use the word victim. Yeah, I certainly would not in
any
way. No,
I understand. I understand. And I get, completely get what you're saying. And,
right.
You know, there's people, I'm sitting here on the south side of Chicago, and within a stone's throw of here, there are people who are struggling with all kinds of challenges. So I get all that, but
certainly, you know, my mom drank as well. And, you know, there were a lot of, you know, sort of demons that are not demons, but, you know, her past was very alive to her. And a lot of those feelings, you know, were things she was continuing to work through her whole life. And I was just, you know, I understood that. And I was very, it made me much more independent at a very early age and much more practical and, you know, survival oriented and wanting to grow up. I wanted to grow up. I just wanted to grow up and like be able to take control of my own life.
We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back with more of the Axe Files. And now back to the show. You and I have, we have a little bit in common in that regard because I came from a very dysfunctional family. My dad died by suicide when I was young, and I just wanted to get on with my life and take control of my life. And you, of course, you know, somehow willed yourself to be a war correspondent at a very young age, and what could be more of an act of independence than that? Let me ask you about we share this this thing about this experience of suicide survival, and we've talked about it before. Your brother Carter died by suicide in 1988, and he slipped from the balcony of your mother's home. And she was there and was trying to save him.
Yeah.
I accept your mother was a resilient and buoyant and, you know, inspiring person in many ways. How did she, that seems to me as a parent, now you're a parent, the worst thing that could ever happen to someone.
Yeah. Yeah, definitely. I mean, it's unimaginable. And yeah, I mean, it's in some ways it was like a bolt out of a clear blue sky. I mean, my brother had some in the last month or two, or like several months before, he had had suddenly some sort of like a weekend where he seemed not himself, and he seemed scared, and he seemed frightened, and kind of not sure of his life and what he was going to do. And I understood that fear. Like, I felt that all the time. And I think we both did. I think I did a better job of preparing myself for, I mean, I literally from the age of 11 set about a course of study of like, how am I going to function in the world? So I started taking survival courses in the wilderness, and I started reading about how adults do things, and started working and earning my own money, which was very helpful to me in terms of just thinking, calming myself so I could sleep at night. And I don't think my brother was practical in that way. And I think the same fears that I had, and neither of us ever talked to each other about it. I, though, just secretly set about a course of preparation. And I think, you know, it's always fascinated me how two people growing up in the same house, you know, one survives and one doesn't. And, you know, I think it was just a few small things that allowed me to not end up the same way. But for my mom, you know, it was, you know, it's beyond comprehension. You know, she took to her bed for, for the first 2 weeks or 3 weeks, she was just in bed, and, you know, I would be there every day, and my brother's friends would come, and she would recount what had happened over and over and over again. And she would talk about it constantly and going through everything. And I, at a certain point early on, I could not listen to it anymore. And, you know, I dealt with things in a different way than she did. And she just sort of cried and cried. And then at a certain point, she stopped crying and really never cried again. She described it as sort of like all the tears were like,
she never cried about that, or never cried about anything.
She certainly cried about she certainly cried, and she did cry about it, but in her mind,
she reached the point, page.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, it never went away. I mean, it certainly has never gone away for me. And it's something I think about every day. And even, you know, toward the end of her life, my mom randomly out of nowhere would suddenly, you know, in the midst of dinner, suddenly, you know, we're walking down the street together, would suddenly say, like, you know, I wonder if I had, you know, hit him with a fire poker from the fireplace to stop him, if that would have stopped him. And, you know, just like ridiculous, you know, the things, kind of crazy scenarios that you think about of, well, is there something else I could have done? And so I think that the shock of it never went away. And it still to this day for me, it stops me in my tracks at times. I mean, I literally have to stop what I'm doing, and because it's just so, it's still like it's what, 1988, it's you know, it's a lifetime ago, but it's still very obviously vivid.
Yeah, I think everyone who's gone through this experience would say the same thing, which is just that it doesn't go away.
Yeah.
To anyone who's listening who are experiencing those kinds of fears, who are lost in that long dark tunnel, talk to someone, get help. Call the Suicide Lifeline, Prevention Lifeline. We'll give that number at the end or at the beginning here. Get help, because there is a way out of that long dark tunnel.
Yeah, there definitely is. I mean, and I think that's one of the things that's so, you know, I think my brother, he sought help. He'd started to see a therapist, but I met with a therapist later to, you know, learn about what had happened. And I realized my brother didn't really talk to the therapist. And so, you know, even if he had just talked to somebody openly and honestly, I think it would have helped tremendously.
Yeah. I mean, the important thing I think to remember is this is not uncommon. I mean, people, this mental illness is like any other illness. A lot of people experience it. You're not alone. You're not going through something that no one's ever gone through before. And there is a way. There are ways. Yeah.
That's the thing that has helped me tremendously throughout my life. That notion that you just said, which is that a lot of other people have gone through this. Like, that is, I mean, I remember as a little kid, I couldn't sleep at nights because I was so worried about, my mom and what's going to happen to us. And, you know, she's spending all this money and I, you know, it's like burning. I could hear the furnace. I imagined I could hear the furnace. I remember reading, I think it was a Virginia Woolf story. And she talked about kind of this hearing this furnace burning in a basement. And I remember reading that and then sort of then imagining this furnace burning in our house or in the storage unit my mom had that was just burning money all the time. And I would literally stay up until, you know, 1 or 2 a.m. when I was a kid worrying, thinking and running through scenarios in my head of how much I need to earn and what if we sold the apartment and then we rented a place for a few years and all this sort of just stuff kids, well, I don't know if it's stuff that most kids think about, but it's certainly something I thought about a lot. And I don't know where I was going.
Is that the reason, just as an aside, I mean, you work your ass off. I mean, I joked about it at the beginning.
Yeah, that is the reason. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I think nothing is, you know, nothing is stable and nothing is, everything can be taken away. And I consciously started traveling to places where everything had fallen apart because I wanted to understand how do you operate in that environment and what happens when everything falls apart. And I found I could actually operate in that environment as a reporter and I could tell stories and I could learn from people and I could shine a light on things. But initially, I think a lot of my desire to kind of go to places, you know, that other people didn't really even consider going to because of danger or, well, why would you go? I remember friends of mine when I first went to Sarajevo in the early years of the war being like, what are you doing? Like, why are you going to, you know, why would you go to this place? And to me, it just seemed like, why wouldn't you? Of course, why wouldn't you go? I mean, not only are hundreds of thousands of people under siege and this is something it's important to bear witness to what's happening, but you know, it's an extraordinary, horrible thing that's happening and it's important to understand and see it. And yeah. And so
I was asking a slightly different thing, which is just in terms of financial stability. Mm-hmm. I mean, are you driven that way?
Oh yeah.
As well?
It completely warped. It's definitely, they say like wrestlers and people who've done lightweight crew have eating, you know, issues for the rest of their life because of like losing weight early on. And I was a coxswain on a crew team and that I can definitely attest. I think that is probably true. And this is certainly true. I mean, I definitely, money is not like the focus of why I do what I do, but the idea of working to me, it's my mom. I once heard my mom say when I was a teenager walking up the stairs, I heard her talking on the phone. She said, well, I'll always be able to make money. And I remember stopping in my tracks and thinking, we are doomed. Like this ship is going down if that's her attitude. And so that has never been my attitude. I believe everything will be taken away tomorrow.
No, when my dad died, I think he left me $17,000, which was enough to get me through college. Mm-hmm. And I mean, it was not enough for him to take care of all the things that he needed to. And the pressures were part of what was playing on his mind. And for the longest time, I worried about reaching his age, which was 63 at that time, and being in that position, it was a real fear. So your mom wrote you a letter that she asked you to open after her death. And in that letter, she said, among other things, that she hoped you would become a father. Mm. And did that influence your decision? Why did you decide to have a child?
I had already decided that, and my mom had made it very clear for a while that she really wanted me to have a kid. I think she knew my dad was a great dad, and I think I'm a lot like my dad, and I think she knew I would be good. I mentioned the story on Stephen Colbert, which I'd never told before, which is, you know, she'd actually offered to carry, I don't know if you've heard this. She'd offered to.
Yeah, I saw that you said that. Yeah.
She'd offered to be a surrogate and carry my child, which was like when she was 85. I mean, the whole thing was insane.
Yes. Yes.
And so crazy and nutty. And so like, even for my mom was pretty nutty. But she had made it clear at the very least that she wanted me to have a kid, and you know, I did not I didn't go to my mom for advice very much. So, you know, when I found this firehouse that I live in, I actually showed it to her and she was like, oh my God, you should absolutely get it. That actually gave me pause because I thought, wait a minute, if she's advising me to buy this and spend money on this, that's probably not, it actually had the opposite effect on me. It actually made me think maybe this is not a good idea. So my mom telling me to have a kid would not necessarily be the motivating factor for me. I wanted to make sure I waited to have a kid because I thought I would, I thought I would be dead at 50 like my father. So I thought I don't want to die on a child just like my dad did. And so I would rather not have a child than put a child through that. And I, you know, when I made it through 50 and I hit 51, that's when I seriously started thinking about it. And my, you know, my doctor's like, you have a bad family history, but you've been taking care of this for 20 or 30 years. And you know, you're going to live, you know, however long you're going to live, but you're going to live into your 70s, the very least. And so, so knock on wood, that's really what I decided. But, you know, she absolutely would have been thrilled to meet Wyatt. She knew I was able to tell her before she died that I was doing this and that I was going to do it. And, I hadn't, you know, started the actual process, but I'd kind of started the ball rolling.
Wyatt, whose name for your dad is, you wrote something in your, maybe the most moving line in this whole book is my dream for him, for Wyatt, is to feel safe and loved and unafraid. Mm-hmm. And that was so powerful in the context of the story of the Vanderbilt family, the story of your mom, your own story. It felt as if you wanted to give to your son what was fleeting in your own life, was elusive in your own life.
I mean, I think that's a common thing with all parents, I would imagine. I mean, I think you want to kind of correct the mistakes of the past and right the wrongs and, you know, be, you know, in my case, I would like to be the dad that my dad was. So I'm not, you know, I was lucky that I had him for 10 years and that was enough to kind of have a grounding and a vision about what a parent is and who I could be. And, you know, that has sustained me all this time. And so,
Your dad wrote a book, a memoir called
Families.
Families. Yeah. And in it, he said, it is in the family that we learn almost all we ever know of loving. In my son's youth, their promise, their possibilities, my stake in immortality is invested. And I thought, geez, what a beautiful sentiment.
Yeah.
Family. And it does sort of, it stands apart from some of the tales you tell in this book of the Vanderbilt family, but what he describes is the ideal that we all
aspire to. Having the fact that he had written this book, I mean, for me, I know he wrote it as a kind of a letter to my brother and I, because I think he knew he wasn't going to probably live to see us, you know, be adults. And
he knew that because he knew he had,
I mean, you know, his sister had died at 38 of heart disease. You know, I think he knew his dad had died pretty young of heart disease. I think he knew, you know, genetically that, you know, and this was back in the 70s when, you know, they didn't really know much about cholesterol and stuff like that. And so, and there weren't statins and there weren't, you know, treatments and, you know, fancy MRIs that can see how much blockage you have and stuff. And so this book really to me has been like a guidepost, you know, and something I read at least once a year, if not more. And, you know, to have him, to have him talk, you know, he talks about my brother and I a lot in the book and it's the closest I can imagine, you know, I don't have video of my dad. I don't, stuff like that. We, you know, there weren't the cameras that there are now and stuff. So, you know, it's like hearing from him and it's been very helpful.
Yeah. What a gift. What a gift. You take all of this away from this book. You say you wanted to write this book for your son. What do you hope that Wyatt, when he is able, what do you hope he takes away from this book?
I think there's benefit in seeing people not as, you know, historical figures, or, you know, the little I knew about the Vanderbilts was stuff, you know, I'd heard, you know, the Commodore was a robber baron, and read it when I was in high school, probably some books, textbooks, and he was probably in them. But I didn't have much sense of these people as actual people with desires and fears and, you know, pluses and minuses. And I think it's, I do think for me, I know, having written this book and learning about these people, I still don't feel part of that lineage, because it so doesn't have anything to do with my frame of mind and frame of reference. But knowing who my great-grandfather was, and my great-great-grandfather, and great-great-great, it does make a difference in my life in terms of feeling connected to this city, which, you know, is a city that they have made a big imprint on, to this country. It makes, I had not appreciated how unique it is to be able to know multiple generations going back to the 1600s of who these family, who your ancestors were, and that it actually does matter, like, in my life. It I'm not saying I, you know, want to have grown up with them, or, you know, I don't want to, I'm not, you know, praising them, but I feel it does make you feel connected to the, what, to the past and the future in a different way, just as having a child does. And I think it's given that, you know, my little family I have now is a unusual family, and there's not a lot of, you know, why won't know who his grandparents were and on my side. And, you know, he won't meet, I mean, there's a few cousins that he'll know and stuff, but there's not a large family for him. I think it's nice for him to at least know who these people were from this book, and who my dad's family were from his book, to feel connected to something much larger than just himself. Because I do think, in terms of being a good citizen and being a good person and being, you know, humble and invested, and not, you know, and not, you know, and being a contributor to society, I think it helps when you feel a sense of connection to those who came before you, and what they were able to achieve and fail at, and mistakes they made. And so that's what I hope. I hope he takes that away from it. And I hope he also takes away that, you know, so much of what our culture encourages from, particularly today, from, you know, someone growing up, of like, well, you can be a TV star, you can be a reality show star, you can, you know, you need to get develop your brand and then maximize your brand and make money, and you know, all of which, you know, look, I work in television, I have a public job, I'm making money, I'm doing something which I really care about, so I can't really complain about people who aspire to that. But I think there's a lot of different things one can aspire to, and ways to, people can contribute and do things. And I don't think, you know, what I do is anything more special or anything than what somebody else does.
And in defense of you, let me say a word in defense of you. You have found a way to make a living doing something about which you're deeply passionate.
Yeah.
You didn't look around and say, how can I make myself the biggest celebrity? How can I, you know, how can I become, you know, fantastically wealthy? How can I, you know, anyone who knows you, anyone who watches you understands the passion you feel for what you do. And so, you're a good example, to your son.
Yeah. I mean, I guess I don't want him to feel, I want him to see his family's history for what it is, the good and bad, and not sort of grow up with a sense of a entitlement, or the sense of that he's part of this thing, when in fact it really has no bearing on who he is and what he is going to be capable of or not capable of. And I don't want him having the baggage of that connection. I want him to be able to walk into a room and people get to know him for who he is and yes. what he brings into that room, and not the associations that people have.
Yeah. Well, as you said earlier, you want for your child what you would have wanted for yourself.
Yeah, and I, you know, I, again, one of the reasons I didn't want the connection with Vanderbilt is because I want, you know, especially I didn't want to walk into a room and have that be what people, that was the first thing in people's minds, because I think it changes the way people see you. And yeah. just as, you know, I think it's much more interesting to be able to walk into a room and not have people, especially as a reporter, to not have people have a preconceived idea about you. I mean, it's harder and harder the more well-known you become, but I think there's great benefit in that.
There is. You cover this world intensively. You know, as I was reading this book, I was, you think about today, we've got billionaires firing themselves into space and this incredible sort of, as you described it, celebrity culture that's being foisted on our kids. And like, what are the parallels between this era, the place we are at, and the history that you've written about here? In terms of wealth and inequality and celebrity, and
it's the same, it's all the same stuff. I mean, it's so fascinating to me. Again, this goes back to the whole history, you know, history repeating itself and patterns that repeat over time in families and also just in society. You know, it's people who have made money in some new technology and some new realm in terms of the Cornelius Vanderbilt. It was, you know, steamships and then railroads, and, you know, are able to amass enormous fortunes, and they think that it's going to last forever and that they are building a dynasty. And what they don't realize is the ripple effects of that money and, you know, the time they are spending doing it on all those around them and those who follow. And, you know, it has unintended consequences, good and bad. And, you know, history is certainly replete with, you know, you can look at the children of famous people and, you know, more often than not, they're not making, you know, they often don't, you know, it often has a negative impact on the child. I thought about that a lot about having a kid, and
yes,
I don't have an answer to it. But I think it's really important to think about that a lot. And I think a lot of, you know, it gets back to something you said earlier. I think it's so important, and I realize I'd lost my train of thought on it, but what I was getting to is this notion has always helped me tremendously, that generations of people before us have gone through the exact same thing, that we all think, oh, the problems that we're dealing with are particularly unique. And obviously the, you know, the depth of them or the permutation of them is unique to the times. But you know, generations of people have been in the exact same situation we've been in. I follow this thing with the AIDS Memorial on Instagram, and it's a memorial for people who died during the you know, the 1980s and 1990s, and even now from HIV/AIDS. And it's a reminder to me that there was a whole generation. There was me here. I was here. There was a me here before living the exact same life I was living, more or less, and they just didn't happen to make it. And seeing their pictures every day on Instagram reminds me of that. And I think it's something, it's a helpful reminder. And I think a lot of people, particularly who are flush with having made, you know, gazillion dollars in the tech world, there's an arrogance where they kind of imagine they are the, you know, that nobody has ever done this before. And it's complete, what they're doing is so extraordinary. And it is so extraordinary. But, you know, you too shall die. I'm a big believer in, you know, memento mori, the, you know, I think remembering that in the end, you know, when Roman generals would return from a great victory, there would be a parade for them and the whole city would turn out to sing their praises. And from what I've read in history, you know, they would have a person standing behind them during the victory celebrations, often an enslaved person, who would whisper to them memento mori, which is remember, you too shall die.
Yeah.
And I think that's a really good thing to keep in mind, and
yes,
for everybody.
Well, let me just say, I've had the privilege of sitting on a set with you for many years on various nights, and I don't think I'm disclosing anything that you would object to. I've had the also privilege of watching you coo at your child through your FaceTime in between our times on the air, and I feel really good for his future. I feel good for his future because he will be loved and he will feel safe and he'll be inculcated with, I think, values that will sustain him. So,
Thank you. I hope so.
Yeah, I feel confident of that. I appreciate you, brother. Thank you
for
spending this time.
My pleasure. Thank you, David.
Thank you for listening. And if you or someone you love is struggling with suicidal thoughts, please call the Suicide Prevention Hotline at 1-800-273-8255. That's 1-800-273-8255.
Thank you for listening to The Axe Files, brought to you by the University of Chicago Institute of Politics and CNN Audio. The executive producer of the show is Allison Siegel. The show is also produced by Miriam Finder Annenberg, Jeff Fox, and Hannah Grace McDonald. And special thanks to our partners at CNN. For more programming from the IOP, visit politics.uchicago.edu.
Quality sleep is essential, and that's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. So you can choose what's right for you whenever you like. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature. Quiets their snores. Sleep Number does that. Sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on Sleep Number limited edition smart beds for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.